So when it first Buddhism first came to America, it was so brash and new, and many people took the wisdom teachings to heart, but didn't even mention the ethical side of things at all. And so it was very easy for people to think that since everything is connected and everyone belongs to everyone else, and it doesn't matter what we do, we're all in this together, and so let's have a party. There weren't any teachings about the precepts, or very, very rarely. And Koban brought them up right away. And then gradually, Eitken Roshi was one of the early ones also, and he's written some books about ethics, Buddhist ethics, that are very good also. So it's a big subject. Sometimes it looks like Buddhism, that the only thing we have to do is just sit. We say that sometimes. That's our practice, just sitting. But we do have to get up. And getting up, we have to find a way to be in the world that is not harmful. For our own sake first, and for the sake of the world. The way these developed, I've always thought, is very interesting because Buddha did not cook them up himself and lay them on his students. He had no rules. If people wanted to be with him, they just asked if they could be with him, and he said, sure. And then they made a robe and followed him. But little by little, people would come to him and say, you know, Joe out there was at the pond the other day and he was killing frogs. What do you think about that, Buddha? And Buddha said, you know, maybe we should all agree not to kill unless we have to. Make an understanding together about this, that we're not going to do that. And then somebody else came and said, do you know what so-and-so was doing? He was doing this really weird sexual thing. What do you think about that, Buddha? And Buddha said, oh, absolutely not. He shouldn't be doing that. We shouldn't. Nobody should be doing that. That's very, very unwholesome. So little by little, these rules were devised and the list became longer and longer. We inherit the first 16 of them, or at least we in Zen have put together 16 that stand for all of them. But men have 200 and some, and women have 300 and some in the conventional, regular Buddhist Theravadin practice. And some of them are quite weird. Some are about things that we would never imagine doing, but that somebody did back there, and they made a rule about it. And every full moon, half moon, quarter moon, they would get together in a circle like this and refresh their minds about and recite these precepts. And if one of them had broken one of them, he stepped forward and confessed. You know, I stole Mary's comb. I'm very sorry, Mary. I won't do it again. So it kept things on track in a way that otherwise maybe couldn't have been done so easily. There's always a big fuss about the fact that women have a whole lot more than men do. And some of it has to do with the time. And not just women's position, which was lowly, but also how dangerous it was in that world. And I suspect that that was the big reason Buddha didn't want women wandering around in robes the way the men were doing, but the women insisted. And so he finally let them in, but he allowed many more rules for them than for men, including very humbling ones, like standing at the end of the line when everybody's lining up for food. And to this day, that's how they do it. In any Theravadan tradition, if you go up to Abayagiri, which isn't very far from here, if you're a woman, you have to stand at the end of the line. Even if you're older and have been ordained longer than any of the men there. So it annoys a lot of people and upsets them, but that's the way it was inherited from the long ago time. So we end up with what we count 16, although there are other ways of counting them because there are different versions of them and different ways of addressing it. But for us, it's a simple 16. And you will now be in possession of them. This is the one that I use for every ordination. It's very, very simple. Did you get two? There should just be one each. Oh, the Bodhidharma's in there too?
It's the Bodhidharma's.
I should have the Bodhidharma one back.
Oh, okay.
I didn't realize it was in there.
Right.
That's for next week.
Okay.
I think it's mostly not, but who knows?
Well, we have the 16.
Yeah, that's the main thing. Oh, okay. Well, I'll sort them out. So although it starts with the a vowel at the top and works its way down in the ceremony, that's the way we do it. The vowel comes first as a kind of way to wake us up to what we're doing and to what we are. That it isn't a way of saying I've been bad all my life and now I'm going to be good, I'm going to be perfect. It doesn't say that at all. It says I'm avowing the way I've been forever, based on my mind and my speech and my body. I've been this way. And then, facing that, we can take refuge in Buddha. That's called the Three Treasures Precepts. And then the Three Pure Precepts, which are the basic, basic teachings of Buddha. The one that when the pompous gentleman asked the master, what are basic teachings of Buddha? He said, well, it's to do good and not to do evil and to save all beings. And he said, well, anybody can know that. And the master said, yes, but any child could do that, understand that. And the master said, yes, but it takes an old, old man even then to be able to practice it. So the prohibitory precepts are the ones that came out of actual life. And that's where I want to begin. It's always a very interesting exercise to take them one by one and take them home and live them for a week. And just pay attention more clearly as they're meant to do for us, and be aware of how they come up in your life. Not on the pages of a book, but in your kitchen, in your car, in your mind. So taking these precepts is a kind of vow. And vowing is a commitment, not to anything, but to oneself. We make our vows to each other when we marry. We take vows in a lot of different ways. But in Buddhism, our vows are very small, but very strong, and forever. There's no way to break the precepts because there's no way to keep them. We kill all day long. We take what's not given all day long. We can't manage to say what's true because we can't really reach the truth with our words. So if you think about it and what these really mean, it can't be achieved. So it isn't about wiping the slate clean and getting all cleaned up and being all perfect. It's about being awake to when we are twisting the truth, to actually notice it and often be very surprised. Did I say that? Did I think I was going to say that? Wow. And then we're better able to act in our life with clarity rather than in mud. It also is about taking responsibility for our life rather than letting our life be lived on automatic. It's accepting that we ourselves have a responsibility for this mysterious and truly wonderful being that we are. So Dido says one thing I want to quote to you. About enlightenment, because that's also comes up. People think, oh, I'll do these vows and I'll take these precepts and then I'm going to get and I'll be an enlightened Buddha. He said, we should know that all the Buddhas within the Buddha way never expect enlightenment. This is Dogen's, actually. He's quoting Dogen. The continuous development of Buddha occurs only through practicing Buddha. Those who believe that Buddha is self-awakening cannot even dream of practicing Buddha. In practicing, Buddha dignity is actualized from start to finish. The dignity appears in the body and transforms by manifesting the way. It covers all time, all eras, all Buddhas, and all practices. If there were not practicing Buddha, there would be no casting off of attachment to Buddha and Dharma. We would just be Buddha demons and Dharma demons. Practice is the verification and the actualization of the enlightenment of all Buddhas, past, present and future. So I wonder if there are comments or questions.
The Eightfold Path is something else then?
Yes. Yes, the Eightfold Path is Buddha's teaching about how to correctly live our life. So it has these in it, but it's a different list. It's a good question. There's 8 of this and 5 of that and 7 of another, so yeah.
These are labeled prohibitory precepts.
Yes.
Affirmatory ones as well.
Yes.
Is that something that...
It's another... It's
difficult or was added on?
I don't know whether it came originally. Probably not. It probably originated as a prohibitory list. That's how it is in the sutras. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere along the line, the positive side was added. And then Bodhidharmas was added after that. So I'll hand that out next week so you all have a different... I want you to see these and really think about them first. Tiff?
So this wording, is this code this wording?
Yes. There's a beautiful book that Gil Fronsdale put together about the precepts, a historical view of it, going all the way back to way before the beginning of time, it seems like. It's a beautiful, beautiful collection of many different translations of these words and other words as well, the vows also. And I'll bring in some of those because that's helpful to see the different ways of saying it. And some of them are quite different. Makes you wonder, you know, what the original really meant. But the basic underlying thing is really all the same. It's really promising to be good. And not good in the sense of what our teachers maybe wanted us to be, which means obedient. But good in the sense of being obedient to our inner sense of rightness and goodness and wholesomeness. And that means finding out what that is. And that's what our practice is discovering that and rediscovering it. Where that deep river of goodness is that runs through us. And this is a way to help us to be that. I'll bring that book in. That'll be good for you all to see. Well, I hope you all will take no killing and enjoy. It means that everything you put in your mouth will have been a killing, for which and why we in Buddhism always express our gratitude for the carrot that whose life sacrifice we have benefited from. And so in a sense we're living the carrot's life. We're taking up the carrot's life and living for it, which is another way of understanding the interconnectedness of all things, that even through our eating we're completely involved deeply involved with everything. And so we're always expressing our gratitude. It was one Thanksgiving meal when my little grandson, who was about 3 then, we had always at dinner bowed before our meal. I never taught the kids anything except that. And he really liked bowing. And at Thanksgiving, all the aunts and uncles and everybody was there. And we were somebody said a little prayer. And then Max spoke up and he said, "We're not bowing." So we all had to stop and bow. Thank you very much. So you'll be surprised. There's some wonderful stories that came out of this. There was one gal many years ago who had trouble with ants in her kitchen. And she was so annoyed with the ants, and she didn't want to kill them. And she tried chalk and all the different things. Nothing worked. And finally, she was so mad one night, they all came back in a flood. She said, "If you don't get out of here by tomorrow morning, I'm going to kill you." And then she went to bed feeling terrible. And she got up in the morning, and they were gone. Well, I hate to tell you, I tried that and it didn't work at all.
I didn't think so. I've been talking to them for weeks and didn't.
Well, for some people, for Melanie, it worked.
Probably a lot of us have been struggling with that precept all week.
Yes, from the large scale way, yes. Yes, it's a terrible dilemma. Yes. Much suffering, just suffering in the middle of the dilemma, not even being able to decide anything. Yeah.
Wrote my congresswoman, but I'm still debating, you know. I'm not ready to be a pacifist.
Nobody knows what to do.
It is a dilemma.
Yeah. Well, I went through this quickly, and we're a little bit early, but we could sit a little bit longer than a minute. Shall we do that? Announcement?
Question. In living the precepts, I'm wrestling again with definitions of philosophy, religion, beliefs. I mean, I truly, truly get more than ever that the precepts are a description of our Buddha nature, how as a human being can truly live. What could I explain something like this to, let's say, my husband or someone that is new to something like this, or trying to discern whether following this may be a Buddhist or not?
Well, I don't think you can explain it to people if they aren't sitting. It's based on Zazen practice, and it goes back to Zazen practice. So it's not worth trying. It just alienates people when they don't understand. And they don't need to if they're not doing the practice. They're doing the practice their own way and don't need they can be invited in, but they can't be told.
I find that carrying it to defining it or saying it is, it feels more like this being a fundamentalist, which is
Well, in a way, it is fundamentalist. No, it's basic. It's very basic. So,
I was still looking for that quick fix.
Well, it's always hard when we're practicing with people who don't practice, and you really want for them to know what it brings, and they don't know. But you can't really, the only way you can give it to them is just to live it yourself as truly and honestly as you can. And that's enough. It's, Ron?
I was going to ask this question, and I think you'll answer it next week anyway when you read some passages, perhaps, from Bill's book. I was going to ask, where did the Buddha get these precepts? You know, we always think of the Ten, the obvious thing that comes to mind, the Ten Commandments, but those are really all for thou shalt not, and then it's pretty definite, according to the story, where they supposedly came from.
Yeah.
Well, they just went up and down. The tablets, you know. Here they are. This is much more so, in a sense. Or maybe it's not any different.
Well, it's kind
of became about with the archbishop's.
Yes, it came out of the ground of us rather than from on high. So it's a very different thing, very, very different. So these precepts are in us. It's just a suggestion that we remember.
Similar though, you're saying it came from above. I mean, whatever the real story is, but you know, Moses was having a hard time talking to God, help me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, whoever it is says, well, I see this is what's going on, this will help you.
Yes,
don't kill, don't do that. I mean, to me, this is like the Ten Commandments, so it results from what's needed,
exactly.
So
however we define where it comes from. Sure.
I always want to justify Buddhism like being like, it's really not special. I mean, first I thought it's like, you know, this is it. But then we were warned not to say this is it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of, well, it's kind of like the Ten Commandments. It's kind of like, I don't know much about Judaism, but so I would like to kind of say it's similar.
Well,
we're all together.
Yes, it is similar.
So we are special, but really we're not.
Exactly, yeah.
So I'm not trying to say that what you said wasn't right, but I kind of want to also say it's the same.
I agree, yes. Yeah. It. Jeffrey?
So, historically, the Book of Deuteronomy, Book of Moses, was done around the same time as the Tipitaka.
Yes.
So, which is really interesting. I don't know, you know, to what degree there were influences historically or culturally.
Well, Confucius was putting his Analects together at about the same time, too. So it was in the air.
It was.
Must have been. When we began to look around and say, we can't live like this. We have to do something. Let's agree. We still don't quite agree, but we're working on it. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I don't know Ten Commandments. And I'm sorry.
Oh.
You don't follow the commandments, but how come?
Not as easy. Or not that it's easy, but it flows better when you do. Yeah, I would say try it and see.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in my religion, you're going to hell. But since I don't want to, you know, go that road, I say, you know what, it'll take me longer to get wherever I'm getting, so...
It's pretty much the same as the precepts. A little bit different, but...
The rules are almost...
Killing, no lying.
Yes. Yeah.
Honor thy father and mother.
Mm-hmm. Well, now it is 8 o'clock.